listening to Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
This is the only live, local, and consistent evening sports radio show in the city of Houston. Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. Patrick Creighton with you. 713-780-3776. 713-780-ESPN. On the HRMP listener line, on the text line, on Twitter at PCreighton1. Andrew Carlson on the other side of the glass, domestic controls, at Carlson Radio, at the model ESPN, at Hotter Than Nick. And, of course, on the Twitch stream, twitch.tv/ESPN975. And we'll certainly take your calls all night on your Houston Astros. Late Hits kind of like a post-game show tonight. That's just kind of how it works tonight. So 713-780-3776, you want to get in. On your Astros, LCS bound for the fifth consecutive year, the White Sox can suck it. We will go and welcome in the Boston Red Sox, who last year dead last in the American League East. This year, LCS bound, which basically means, as Goldberg would say, you're next! You know, a Red Sox scored a lot of runs in that series against the Rays, which probably means they're due to not score a lot of runs because that's just kind of how their season's been. Red Sox are a good team. Astros are a better team. Ash will be playing at home. I would not be surprised if they go to Fenway up 2-0. Chris Sale did not look good in his start against the Rays. Now, I figure he'll be better next time out, but did not look good in his start. Gave him a grand slam in the first inning. He was out of there after one inning. I had a lot of friends up in the Boston area. Man, it's like game on. Game on. Yeah, you know, outside of Nate Eovaldi, if the Red Sox pitch the way that they pitched in this series, well, they're not beating the Astros. Astros are going to – if you're giving up – the Rays score a lot of them, but the Rays just seem to me to be a team that's more built for the regular season than is built for the postseason. You got three rookie pitchers in your rotation. Your lineup consists of two rookie hitters who, you know, were above – you know, two of your best hitters all year. You know, Randy Arozarena for the majority of the season and then Juan DeFranco for, you know, the half the season that he played. You put that many inexperienced guys – in the pressure cooker, and usually you don't win. Now, it gets those guys a lot of great experience, but usually you don't win. Red Sox have a lot of experienced guys on that team, a lot of guys on that team who have been to the postseason, some who have earned a ring in 2018. So this will be a fun series with the Astros and the Red Sox. The fans in Houston will be wild. The fans in Boston will be wild. It'll be a lot of fun. It'll certainly be a better environment going to Fenway than going to the Trop where, you know, maybe they'll get 14,000 people and, you know, we'll have some cardboard cutouts and some pumped-in sound. And, you know, you got to worry about, oh, the ball hit the roof in zone 2 or zone 3. Yeah. Like, which zone did it hit? How many bases are you going to get on that? How they built that stadium for baseball with the roof that they have makes no freaking sense at all. But, you know, the Rays could certainly use a new building, and they can't get one, which is why they're talking about to play in half their games in Montreal and half their games in Tampa, and that probably logistically is a nightmare. But they're talking about it because you know who's third from the bottom in attendance? The Tampa Bay Rays. Third from the bottom. Astros, I think, were sixth this year in attendance, which not too shabby. Your top six in attendance in a COVID year, people are coming to your park. And we know in the postseason, everybody's coming to the park. It'll be a lot of fun. And we'll get to that. You know, this last game here, 10-1 victory over the White Sox. And you think about how many guys contributed to this victory. And, you know, one of the guys who's actually played pretty well in this series was Jake Myers. And Jake Myers gets hurt early in the game. He tries to go up and over the wall to catch a home run in the second inning. and he goes up over the wall, and it's like a weird barrier there over the wall, and he arm comes over, and he kind of lands on top of the wall, and his arm bends a weird way, and then he lands hard, and he was down for a little bit, and trainers came out, and he tried to throw, and oh yeah, look, I'm okay, I can throw, I'm okay, and well. Yeah, he wasn't really okay. He was having a lot of trouble with it. He wasn't throwing that hard. And he said, you know, it feels like my shoulder's going to pop every time I throw the ball. And Carlos Correa having a conversation with him. Look, trust your teammates. We're going to get you home. So, you know, you don't need to play hurt. You don't need to risk getting injured and then not being able to play for the rest of the postseason. We got you. Go get taken care of and take care of yourself. So we'll learn more about the injury to Jake Meyers probably in the next 24 hours or so. Chas McCormick came in. And this is one of the things that from the beginning of the year to now, one of the biggest differences in this team, you know, in the beginning of the year, we were worried about, okay, well, what are the Astros going to be in center field? You know, you're Miles Straw and Chas McCormick, and neither one of these guys are really proven at the major league level. Chas has really been a corner outfielder in the minors. He hasn't been a center fielder, but he's got great speed, and you know he can certainly track things down. And here we are at the end of the season, and we're not looking at center field as a question mark. We actually look at it as a strength because Meyers has played terrific defensive baseball, and he's hit very well. Chas McCormick, surprising power this year. He's never shown that kind of power at any level of minors. And he, of course, is surprised in center field, a position he didn't have a lot of experience in. And he's played very well. And then you call up Jose Siri, who is dealing with a fractured finger. But Jose Siri, another guy like Jake Meyers, he flat out go get it. And now what in the beginning of the year was a question mark. Today is a strength. You've got three guys who can flat out go run it down in center field, and they've all hit with, you know, some level of aptitude. Chas has hit fairly well. Jake Meyers hit really well. Jose Siri was raking. So center field, even though, like, we don't know how bad the injury is for Meyers. Is he going to be able to play in the LCS? If he's not able to play in the LCS, might he wind up being on the team and, you know, for a World Series if they go that far? And, you know, obviously, if we're looking at, okay, well, what do they do? If Jake Meyers isn't able to play, or, you know, he's not going to be on the roster because, you know, he's dealing with a shoulder injury, does that mean Marwin Gonzalez now makes the roster? Because you've got to figure out, all right, if how bad is Siri's hand? Can Siri put on a glove and catch the ball? If he can, well, that's the guy who's going to be your backup center fielder. And, you know, look, Aledmys Diaz can play left, and Michael Brantley obviously stealing a base today. Legs obviously are feeling good enough for him to be playing the field. Tucker's okay. You know, he's not feeling any ill effects from anything earlier in September. So Chas probably winds up being your starter, and Jose Siri's your backup fielder. He's your pinch hitter. He's your pinch runner. He's maybe the late inning defensive replacement. Marwin, who can't play center but could play left, does Marwin then make the team? Because even though playing Diaz and right, I don't think is a good idea. We have seen Diaz play right a couple of times. He has enough arm to play right. His range is weak, but he's got the arm. But Diaz could play left if you needed him to. Then Marwin could play left if you needed him to. You've got Chas and you've got Siri. And look, in a pinch, Kyle Tucker can play center field. Like if stuff really hit the fan, you could get away with, for a handful of innings, an outfield with Yordan in left, Tucker in center, and Brantley in right. That is your worst defensive alignment. But you could get away with it if you absolutely had no other choice because injuries just exploded all over you. So I think if Meyers is not able to play in the ALCS, I think Marwin's got a shot to get on. The roster. Troy, you're on Late Hits. What's up, Troy?
Hey, what's going on, Patrick? Just a couple of comments. First of all, Tony La Russa's a stooge. He's an idiot. And second of all, I think Tucker coming out there still in second and still in third, I think he just kind of made a statement. We're coming right at you. We're going to smack you in the mouth, and we're not afraid of you. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, tell you what, Troy, when you call Tony La Russa a stooge, it's really inappropriate. Proper terminology is drunken stooge. All right, if we're going to call them names, let's get the name calling right. Drunken stooge. And look, Tucker stealing second and stealing third. I mean, that hasn't been done in the playoffs in ages. So, and look, Tucker's got more speed than people realize because he's tall. He's got long legs. He takes long strides. He doesn't look... Like, when Chaz McCormick's running, he looks like Speedy Gonzalez, right? Everything's going 100 miles an hour, and he looks like he's busting it. When Tucker's going, he looks like he's gliding. He doesn't look like he's, like, super busting it, but he covers a lot of ground with every stride. He's a lot faster than people realize, and I thought that the Astros taking the bases, really from the get-go, they stole four bases today. Really from the get-go, in intimidating White Sox pitching. And this is something the analytics guys will never understand. Analytics devalues the stolen base extremely. Like they don't even want to talk about stealing bases. Stolen bases intimidate pitchers. Stolen bases make fielders anxious. Because every time there's a stolen base, there's a throw. That throw gets away. Now it's two bases. Guy stealing third base and the throw gets down the line. That's he's walking home. Hell, he's walking home backwards. Stolen bases change games. They change series. One of the most famous stolen bases is Dave Roberts in the 2004 ALCS stealing second base off Mariano Rivera in the ninth inning in game four. The Red Sox were down 3-0. They were on the verge of being swept. Dave Roberts steals second base, and the entire series changes. Red Sox steal that game, and then they win game five. And then they win game six. And in game seven, Kevin Brown and Javier Vasquez got taken to the woodshed. So that stolen base does a lot of damage psychologically to the other team. And that's why I love stealing bases. I love stealing bases. You mess with the catcher, now he can't throw you out. Now he can't hit either because he's too busy thinking about how he can't throw you out. 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN, Two-Way Sports Talk Hotline. We're talking Astros baseball going to the LCS for the fifth straight year. Late hits.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
So, Jose Altuve, with his 19th career postseason homer, that now puts him in a tie for fourth all time in postseason home runs. It also puts him in a tie for first all-time postseason home runs as an Astro. Jose Altuve, George Springer, 19 postseason home runs. That's pretty good, by the way, for those of you keeping score at home. In fact, that list is Jose Altuve, George Springer, Albert Pujols. One more home run, and Altuve will be tied with Derek Jeter for third all time. Three more home runs, and he'll be tied with Bernie Williams. Second all time. he's going to need a couple of postseasons to catch Manny Ramirez, who has 29. But it is very possible before 2019 is over. Jose Altuve could be second all-time postseason homers. And obviously, he would be number one as an Astro. Other fun tidbits of the day. Carlos Correa drove in his 54th postseason run. 54 playoff RBI for Carlos Correa has him tied for sixth all time. Not as an Astro. He is number one as an Astro. Did you hear that? The guy that the Astros are debating whether or not they should pay, who not only is an elite offensive player at his position, is the best defensive player at his position, is the team captain, is also number one in team history in playoff RBI and number six all time in postseason RBI, tied with Albert Pujols. Pay that man his money. There is no five because four is also a tie. Would you like to know who's tied for fourth? Derek Jeter and Big Poppy are tied for fourth, 61 RBI postseason. One hot series. Guess who's in the mix? And we're not going to pay that guy? We're not going to pay that guy? Who's 26 years old? We're not going to pay that guy? Look. I'm going to speak directly to Jim Crane right now because I know Jim Crane is listening. Jim Crane always listens to my show. I know this. He also reads all my work. So that's actually how I met Jim Crane. Back in 2013, I wrote an article on the Astros and their proposed way of trying to generate money with their TV revenue and run money on how they said they wanted to run their franchise, similar to the way the Braves, the Cardinals run their franchise. And I did a big deep dive into that and took apart all the numbers for those teams and then compared them to the Astros. And I got a phone call from Jim Crane out of nowhere. Understand, at the time, 2013 was my first year in Houston. And you know, I was a part-timer at Sports Radio 610. And Jim Crane personally picked up the phone to call me. He even left a voicemail because I was on air, so I didn't take the call. I didn't recognize the number. B, I'm on air. Hi, this is Jim Crane. First year here, and I'm like, oh, dang. I got a call from Jim Crane. That's pretty cool. And he invited me down to Minute Maid Park. And it was really cool that I got a sit-down interview with Jim Crane. And he probably gave me about an hour of his time. And that was the first time I'd met him. And he was very candid and very open. And every question I asked, he answered. And he answered in full. Like, he didn't give me any nonsense answers. He gave me straight, legit answers. And I respected the fact that he gave me legitimate answers. So I did another story on him based on everything that he said. And the biggest takeaways that he gave me from that interview were they needed to, A, really redo the organization from top to bottom, that the organization he inherited had a lot of inflated salary, did not have a lot of talent. The minor leagues were bereft. They really had to start over from scratch. That they were going to rebuild things from the bottom up. They did. That right now, look, we're not spending a lot of money right now, but we're also, essentially, we're not trying to win. So we're not just going to throw money out the door. We can lose for cheap just as much as we can lose for expensive. So we might as well lose for cheap. when it's time to spend money, when we're ready to get the talent from the minors up to the majors, and we're close, and we're just a couple players away, we will spend money. And he did. Jim Crane has been true to his word, really, for everything that he said. He's been true to his word. The only time you can even maybe say he hasn't been true to his word was when before the 2020 season they said, hey, you know what, we'll go for it at the deadline. And then they didn't. They didn't make any moves at all. They made no moves at all, and the team went into a funk. Ultimately, that's why they finished two games under, was they went into a funk right after the deadline when they didn't make any moves. Then they kind of got it back together later in the season, and they go on the run to the ALCS. So you knew the talent was still there. This year, you know, it was, well, we're going to make moves, but we're going to be smart about it. We're going to watch the tax line. We knew they were going to watch the tax line. When they said, hey, in the right situation, we'll go over, we knew the right situation was Max Scherzer. If they could get Max Scherzer, they'd go over the line. If they couldn't get Max Scherzer, then there was no reason to go over the line. And look, James Click did a really nice job of upgrading the bullpen without giving away assets and without taking on salary. Did a nice job. Now, did all those guys pitch as well in the regular season after they got them as they did wherever they were before? Not necessarily. But they were still better than what the Astros were putting out beforehand. And you didn't give up anything to get them, and you didn't take on salary. So this was not a bad offseason, in-game, not a bad trade deadline for James Click. And this is going to be his first offseason where they're going to have money. Now, they're going to have to pay some guys because you got some arbitration guys who are going to get raises, but they're generally not going to be monster raises. The guy who's going to get the monster raise if you pay him is Carlos Correa. And like with all the young outfielders that have come up this year and that they're still developing, at the end of the year, it might be time to part ways with Michael Brantley. Or maybe you keep Michael Brantley and you part ways with Justin Verlander. You know, they're going to offer him a QO, and the QO is actually going down this year. I think it's like $18.4 million this year is the qualifying offer. And Verlander's going to turn down the QO. And all that's really going to happen is whoever signs Verlander, the Astros are going to get a pick. The whole point of the QO is to attach a draft pick compensation to that guy that you lose in free agency. So if you decide, hey, I'm not going to go spend 30-something million dollars, let's say $25, $30 million on Justin Verlander. Well, there's $33 million on Verlander and there's $26 million on Zach Greinke. You can afford to pay Carlos Correa. Now, I don't know what Marcus Stroman's going to want on the open market, but if Marcus Stroman wants $25 million or less, I think he's a buy. If Marcus Stroman wants over $25 million, I'd say that's a pass. Because the reality is you have McCullers, you have Framber Valdez, you have Jose Urquidy, you have Luis Garcia. You've got four young pitchers, three of whom you're not even paying yet. One of whom is on an incredibly team-friendly contract. You don't necessarily need to go spend a ton of money on a guy if he wants, you know, if Stroman wants crazy money, then maybe you don't need to go out and spend a ton of money on that guy. Marcus Stroman's a really good pitcher. And he's coming off of a year where he made just under $19 million. Now, Stro just turned 30 years old. If you're telling me you can get him, you're probably, what, 5 years, $25 million a year? Do I want to go 5 years on a 30-year-old pitcher? I don't know. I might let that be somebody else's problem. The Astros have been really good about finding, you know, guys on short-term contracts who have provided value. You know, would I rather have Charlie Morton for 1 year or Marcus Stroman for five based on all the young talent the Astros have? I think I'd take Charlie Morton for 1 year. Till it hits.
ESPN 97.5. This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
Hey, let me talk about our friends down at the West Bar and Grill. You know, the West is a Beaumont institution. The West, always a great place to catch all the games all the time. In fact, if you're down there watching Astros playoff baseball, there'll be $3 Crawford Bock pints during all those Astros games. And on Sunday, you want to watch all the NFL games? Well, you need a bar and grill that's got the Sunday ticket. Not every place in Beaumont has the Sunday ticket, but you know who does? The West. And with a menu with steaks and shrimp, wings, burgers, and catfish, you'll be eating like a champ. They've got all your favorite beers, wines, and spirits, so you'll be drinking like a champ, watching the games, rooting on your teams to win, enjoying your drinks, enjoying your meals while you enjoy the game, or maybe while you play your favorite pub games, because if you like pub games, well, guess what they got at the West? All of them. Pool, darts, ping pong, shuffleboard, arcade games. All of them at the West. Happy hour in effect all day till 6 o'clock. Ask for my buddy Mike Hamilton. Mike's the owner. He's going to take great care of you. The West Bar and Grill, 6445 Calder Avenue in Beaumont, half mile north of I-10. Check out their Facebook page for events at the West Bar and Grill. Get your friends together and head to the West, a Beaumont institution. Now, we have spent a lot of time talking about the Astros, and deservedly so, because the Astros going to the ALCS for the fifth straight year, pretty freaking awesome. Don't know how anybody could not enjoy all that. But you know what else happened recently, Saturday night? We got a hell of a heavyweight fight. And 11th round stoppage, Tyson Fury taking down Deontay Wilder, who this time got his wish. He went out on a shield. 11th round stoppage in Tyson Fury, and still the heavyweight champ. I'll tell you what, probably from like the 6th round on, I don't know how the hell Wilder is standing up. I mean, it was wild. I mean, the third round, and Fury puts Wilder on his ass. And it's, oh, wow, this might be over soon. But in the 4th round, Wilder, who looks like he's in trouble, all of a sudden lands a monster right hand and Fury goes down. And now, holy cow, he just knocked Fury down. And it's like, where did that come from? Totally out of the blue. And then he put Fury down again like 30 seconds later. Almost like Fury hadn't recovered from the first shot yet. Fury gets knocked down twice in the 4th and it's like, no way, is Wilder really going to take him down? 2 knockdowns in the 4th. And in the 5th round, it was like Tyson Fury, wasn't he just on his back? Because here's Tyson Fury, aggressive, stalking, dominating, and Wilder looks like he's in trouble again. And it was really, despite being knocked down twice, man, Tyson Fury, from the 5th round on, absolutely dominated that fight. I would actually say the only 2 rounds that I gave to Wilder the entire fight were round 1 and round 4. Fighters each threw a similar number of punches. Fury threw 385 punches and Wilder threw 355 punches. And I'm just trying to think, like, AC, if you threw 355 punches, how much do your arms hurt?
Oh, man.
That's a lot of punches.
That's a lot of work.
And yet here it landed. This is the crazy one, right? Wilder threw 355 punches and landed 20%. Not great, but that's still landing like 70-some-odd punches. Tyson Fury landed 39% of his punches. That's a freaking lot. And here is a great one. When you get into jabs, you're talking about, you know, throwing jabs. Just everything is set up off a jab. Fury landed 31% of his 117 jabs. Wilder landed 9% of his 102 jabs. Fury kept Wilder at bay. He kept him at a distance the whole fight. And it was hard for Wilder to get inside. And when he did get inside, what did we see? We saw Fury grabbing him, holding him, leaning on him, tying him up, putting him in a... How many times did Fury have been in a headlock? I mean, like 5 times around. And all the extra weight that Wilder put on, thinking, I'll bulk up, I'll be stronger so that Fury can't lean on me. Well, Fury still outweighed him by almost 40 pounds and was still leaning on him and headlocking him and tying him up. And all that happened is Wilder looked gassed a lot earlier than you'd think he'd look. He was gassed. I mean, hell, in the 6th round, we're looking at Wilder and going, man, Wilder looks like he's out of gas. He's trying to load up that right hand, and nothing's coming. Like, it doesn't have the snap. It doesn't have the pop. Wilder hit Fury with some right hands, clean right hands later in the rounds, but, you know, whereas in the 4th round, it put him on his ass. Well, in the 8th round, Fury ate it and smiled. Now that same power is not behind it because he's tired. And it shows you how great Fury really is. An amazing, amazing competitor, because you look at him. He's huge. He's 6'9". He's damn near 280 pounds. He doesn't have that killer physique that so many guys have now. I mean, Wilder came out looking like an action figure. He was 240 and ripped. Fury's not ripped. Not even close. Yet, he's so light on his feet. He's got great footwork. He's nimble. Early in the fight, Wilder came out throwing jabs to the midsection, thinking, well, you know what, Fury doesn't have that crisp tone midsection like I do. I'm going to go get him. Didn't work. And in the 11th round, despite throwing almost 400 punches, Tyson Fury dancing, stalking, swinging. For a guy his size, it's unbelievable that he could do that. And right now, I point to anybody in the heavyweight division. I don't think anybody's got a prayer in hell at beating Tyson Fury right now. He might be champ for a while, like several years. I don't think anybody can legitimately, between his size, his power, his endurance. I mean, how many times this fight, he knows, he's got this innate knowledge where he just knows exactly how much range his opponent has. And so many times he's just an inch or two outside the range of Wilder. And Wilder's throwing a punch in Fury, turns the shoulder, rolls the shoulder, slides ahead. Like, he's never, so many times, he's never in danger. He knows no matter how hard he throws, you're not hitting me. He made Wilder miss so many shots. Wilder thought he was going to absolutely unload on him. Next thing you know, like, Fury's ducking under a close range right hand and follows with an uppercut. And next thing you know, Wilder's stammering 3 steps back. Wilder came into this fight aggressive, confident, built up, chiseled, and he left busted. And, you know, when you heard Tyson Fury say, I'm the best and he's the second best, he's probably telling the truth. Deontay Wilder might be the second best heavyweight. But in fairness, he's lost the last 2 fights decisively. And while the first fight was considered a draw, I thought he lost that one too. There's no question he can't beat Tyson Fury. I don't know that anybody can. We'll head back to the phones. 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN. Steve, you're on Late Hits. What's up, Steve?
Hey, great fan of the show. I was just going to say that being a Raider fan a long time and everything, I'm taking a lot of heat and everything. The day that he got fired, I actually said I think John Gruden should be fired because of his coaching abilities. I only knew about the very first one, about the remark he made about the NFLPA executive. I think in the long run, obviously, like my brother-in-law used to tell me, Steph, before you send an email, make sure you read it one more time, because a lot of times, you know, you might be thinking, oh, you get all caught up in the moment and you want to tell somebody, or someone did something that really made you mad. He said, go ahead and read it one more time before you send it out to make sure that's what you want to send out. His ego got him fired. I think in the long run, the Raiders are going to be a better team. I have a feeling that Gruden wasn't the right fit 3 years ago. And what say you about this? I think organizationally, the thing that concerns us is the timing of this. With, who leaked it? Was it somebody in the Raiders? Maybe Mark Davis wanted him gone because he saw that this team was going to be mediocre again. What do you think?
I'll tell you what, I do not think the Raiders are mediocre. I think the Raiders are a lot better than most people thought, and I've been on that bandwagon all year, that I think the Raiders are a much better team than people have been giving them credit for, and I think their play has reflected that. That being said, you know, Gruden was not working in the NFL at the time these emails were sent. These emails were sent 10 years ago. Apparently, Bruce Allen does not delete emails, ever. Gruden was working for ESPN. He was coaching. I think he was doing some high school football and some youth football. And the NFL decided to lock the players out, basically to just claw back money. The previous deal with the players was the players were getting, I think, 57% of the money, 56, 57% of the money. And the NFL realized, hey, we can bully the players. We're going to get that 57% of the money. And they locked them out. And they said, here's the new split, 57-43. Like it, don't like it, we don't care, but that's what you're going to get. And players didn't like it, so they didn't sign it. So they got locked out. And ultimately, they caved. And Gruden was... You know, admittedly, he was very angry. He didn't like the way the NFL was treating the players. Didn't like what it was doing to the game. You get, you know, at the time there were also, you know, straight up denial about concussions in the NFL, and you know they were suing doctors who said, well, yeah, you're playing in the NFL, you're banging heads, you're going to get concussions. Duh. They were suing doctors to shut them up so they couldn't say that. They were in straight up denial mode on concussions in the NFL. And people were, you know, starting to be afraid of putting their kids into football because they didn't want their kids getting hurt, whatnot, with brain injuries. Gruden was angry, and he and Bruce Allen had a lot of communications. And Gruden said a lot of stuff that you shouldn't be saying. And the fact that it was leaked, what he said about D. Smith, who is the NFLPA president, the fact that it was leaked, what he said, and he didn't lose his job right then and there, gives you an indication of where the NFL is when it comes to what you can and can't say. When you went racist against a black man, you didn't lose your job. When it came out, oh, he said stuff about Roger Goodell, he was out 24 hours later. And let me tell you what I think about coincidences. There's no such thing as a coincidence. Coincidence doesn't exist. I do not think it was an accident in any way, shape, or form. He talked junk about D. Smith, and he was probably going to get reprimanded and fined. He talked smack about Roger Goodell, and he's out. And I think this hurts the Raiders a lot because he wasn't just the coach. He was the de facto head of the snake, and everybody in there was working for him. Now you've got a GM whose job was to listen to the coach, and now Mike Mayock has to make decisions on his own. Now you've got to go get a coach in the middle of a season where your team is in contention in the AFC West. Your team's in there, and now you need a new leader. And that locker room is fractured because of what Gruden said and did. This is very, very damaging for the Raiders this year. And it's probably going to take them until the offseason to get a new leader, restructure the organization, who's going to lead top down and try to recover from the damage that's been done to them over the last 5 days. Home stretch is next. Late hits.
Years of research and innovation.
Innovation Map is the new voice of innovation in Houston.
Pretty cool, huh, Morty?
Covering startups, tech, energy, health, social impact, and more. Visit innovationmap.com today.
Do it now! Do it! Do it! Do it now!
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, home stretch, Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. You know, this whole thing with Gruden is crazy from this point of view. The investigation is into the Washington football team. This is an investigation about female employees being sexually harassed by the team. What about their team cheerleaders being secretly videotaped when they got undressed by team employees? The team was fined $10 million by the league. And Daniel Snyder had to step down basically as the guy handling day-to-day responsibilities. And his wife, Tanya, took over. Which basically means Daniel Snyder still runs the team, just his wife's face is there and not his. But the attorneys for the 40 employees who are suing the Washington football team over sexual harassment put out an absolutely scathing statement against the NFL and against the Washington football team. This is stuff. Let me tell you, here is the statement by Lisa Banks and Deborah Katz. These are the two lawyers who represent the former 40 former employees of the Washington football team who are suing for sexual harassment and abuse. It is truly outrageous that after the NFL's 10-month-long investigation involving hundreds of witnesses and 650,000 documents related to the longtime culture of harassment and abuse at the Washington football team, the only person to be held accountable and lose their job is the head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders. If the NFL felt it appropriate to release these offensive emails from John Gruden, which it obtained during its investigation into the Washington football team, it must also release the findings related to the actual target of the investigation. Our clients and the public at large deserve transparency and accountability. If not, the NFL and Roger Goodell must explain why they appear intent on protecting the Washington football team and owner Dan Snyder at all costs. There is going to be a reckoning. These two women are out for blood, and deservedly so, apparently. But here you have the attorneys who just put the NFL on blast. We know you leaked the Gruden emails. And if that's the case, did the NFL basically make Gruden the fall guy because they read the emails and Gruden apparently said some not-so-nicey-nice things about Roger Goodell? And what do I always tell you? There's no petty like sports petty. That Roger Goodell, all right, let's leak these bad boys. And first it comes out about D. Smith, and you know what? That fractures the locker room. And then it comes out about Roger Goodell, and the next thing you know, he's out of a job. And what does that do? Well, what takes the focus off of anything going on with the Washington football team, right? The big story is, wow, what a bad guy John Gruden is. What a racist, sexist, homophobe John Gruden is. The Tampa Bay Bucks are removing him from their ring of honor because, well, John Gruden's a racist, sexist, homophobe, and he's going to need, the A-Rod, image overhaul, reimaging overhaul. He's going to need the A-Rod style in order to get back on TV next year. And I think he's going to be back on TV next year because, you know, that always works for rich guys. But the NFL has some splaining to do. How come the emails that were sent to Bruce Allen 10 years ago from John Gruden, how come those are leaked, but the ones from the team itself and team employees, you know, the ones that you're actually investigating, how come all of that is still under lock and key?
Someone had to take a fall, Pat.
Why was Gruden selected? And to me, the obvious answer is he took shots at the king. It doesn't matter they're 10 years old. He took shots at the king. And when you take shots at the king, well, 99% of the time, your head rolls. John Gruden's head is rolling right now because he ticked off Roger Goodell. Never mind the racist comment about D. Smith. Never mind whatever sexist and homophobic comments he made in other emails. They were going to let all that slide. They'd probably fine him, maybe suspend him for a game. But, I mean, a fine was probably what was coming. Then it was, well, you know, I said some stuff about Roger Goodell that's not very flattering. And a day later, bye-bye. I'm sorry, I don't think that's an accident. And if the NFL is hell-bent, we're going to punish John Gruden because he talks smack about the commish, but we're still trying to sweep everything with the Washington football team under the rug. I mean, look, they fined him $10 million, which I don't know if that's the most they can fine him. But in reality, if that's the kind of culture that's been going on in the Washington football team for a decade, why would you allow Dan Snyder to continue on the team? I mean, they didn't have any problem getting Jerry Richardson out of the NFL when he was, you know, trying to play with every woman's feet in his organization. Why does rampant sexual harassment and assault, why does that get a pass in the nation's capital? Because Dan Snyder's really rich. Jerry Richardson was really rich. NFL has to explain, why is it that you're protecting Dan Snyder? Why are you protecting the football team? Why aren't you making this guy sell the team? Why aren't you doing more? And why did you single out John Gruden as the one bad guy? Because I am 1,000% sure he's not the only guy who sent Bruce Allen some off-color emails. It's going to do it for us for tonight. Appreciate my man AC on the other side of the glass. All our callers, texters, tweeters, and twitchers. Guess what? We're back tomorrow, 7 o'clock, right here on ESPN 97.5. Only tomorrow, we're going to the ALCS. So Friday, buckle up. Go get your gear tomorrow. See you tomorrow. Have a good night, H-Town!
You're listening to ESPN 97.5.
We're taking a break.
Okay. That's cool.